hope so far you've been enjoying your practice. Everything okay so far? Yeah. Now it seems such an ordinary, normal thing that we take for granted. But in actual fact, it is a very unlikely thing that we ordinary American people living in America here, without a long heritage of Buddhist practice, are able to do this, to spend a whole day practicing Zazen. I mean, think about it. In all of ancient, endless, cosmic time, all of you and me just happened to be born at the right time to be able to encounter the Dharma. And not only did we have that good fortune to be born at the time when it was possible to encounter the Dharma, but then also to be born to be people who somehow or other, it would appear, decided that it would be a good idea to practice the Dharma and to spend the precious day of our human life like we're spending it today. And I often think about this in my own case. Looking back on my life now, I really don't know why exactly. It seemed to me so long ago like a good idea to devote my whole life to Zen practice. Obviously, I had no idea what I was undertaking. And yet, something made me want to do it. And now I'm really glad that that happened. To sit Zazen is to be free. Free from the world. Free from suffering. And free from yourself. Zazen is like space, a big opening that you can't really grasp or define. That, just like space, generously includes everything within it, rejecting nothing at all. And yet at the same time is beyond whatever it contains. To sit in Zazen is to go beyond everything. To be here in such a profound sense that it's almost as if you're not here at all. Something like that. And even though you sit in Zazen and you might not describe it the way I just described it, and you might just think it's just me sitting here with my troubled thoughts or my stupid thoughts or whatever, that actually is what's going on. And every now and then you notice. The other day, for some reason, I was recalling how at the beginning of the Trump presidency, at that really shocking moment for so many people, I felt responsible to comment publicly on what was going on. So I began to experiment with political Facebook posts. And what I was trying to do was calm things down. I was trying to reassure people who were really freaked out that, bad as this might be from their point of view, the world was actually not coming to an end. And especially that it was not necessary or advisable for anyone on either side to demonize and loathe the other side. That was what I was trying to post about. And I posted a lot, and I kept it, you know, I'm short and clear, and I was hoping kind. And a fair number of people read my posts, and I got a lot of comments. And there were, on a pretty regular basis, fights that broke out over my posts. Somebody would comment about the post, and then somebody would comment about the comment, and before you knew it, there were long fights breaking out, and sometimes people were mad at me for what I had said, even though what I said was pretty anodyne. So I did this for a little while, and then I realized I was actually not doing what I was trying to do. I realized that it actually didn't matter what I said. No matter what I said, and no matter how I said it, it always came out Facebook-ese. And the medium itself, you know, unintentionally, of course, spun my words always into something that I didn't mean, which I could see by the comments. It was staggering to me. The same words turned out to mean something other than what I intended them to mean when I wrote them. And this was, to me, you know, a really interesting educational phenomenon. And I realized that I was trying to calm things down and bring some peace to the situation, but I was not at all doing that. I was just pushing the platform, pushing the toxic conversation, stirring things up more, increasing the volume, and basically making things worse. So I stopped doing that. A few years ago, a young, bright young tech guy who maybe some of you have heard about, named Tristan Harris, showed up at our annual Mardi Hade session. He's a really bright fellow. He had been had high positions in the best tech firms, and now he had become a tech critic. And the main thing that he was saying was that technology, especially social media, is addictive, and that it's having a really bad effect on us. And what made him mad, and what he was really crusading against, was the fact that he knew that the tech companies were aware of this, and rather than doing something to ameliorate it, they were cashing in on it. So ever since meeting Tristan and hearing this from him, I've been paying attention to this. And I can't help but notice that I am addicted to my iPhone. Maybe you can relate to this. I'm in finding myself in odd moments scrolling down the news, checking the news several times a day. Sometimes I still go and look at Facebook and scroll down on Facebook. And I find that in the middle of a conversation, I'm often Googling things, you know, that I don't really need to know. I have the app, so I go to the Giants website a lot, check the scores, see if there's any new scuttlebutt in the baseball world. And I'm even like clicking on shopping links, because it's hard not to click on a link that they send you that they know you're interested in, because somehow they know you better than you know yourself. And my phone somehow lets me know when something has happened that I should know about, it thinks. If I get an email or a text. And I can't help but look at the phone when it wants my attention. It always manages to get it. sometimes in quick succession. It's four or five or more notices of the same event in the world, which sadly is a shooting or a death. In other words, I'm often in a state of distraction with my phone. So now it's not just Tristan Harris complaining about this. I think everybody's complaining about this. And the many articles and podcasts about this and all the different ways to cope with it and all the stories of people who are suffering from this are themselves addicting and distracting. And isn't it terrible that here I am this morning when you finally manage to get away from all of this? Maybe you don't even have your phone in your pocket right now. Here I am, distracting you again and getting you agitated all about this thing that everybody talks about and nobody can do a thing about. But what an amazing device an iPhone is. It's a wonderful thing. And what a great person, you know, a genius, Stephen Jobs and the whole Apple team are, you know, so skillful. And after all, you know, this is the Bay Area and there are guys, there are local heroes, right? The iPhone truly is a marvel of human ingenuity. I think it's one of the greatest devices ever invented. This little thing, you know, who could believe? I grew up before there were any computers, and now to think, this little thing that fits so nicely in the palm of your hand, you don't even want to put it down. It's so nice, you know, isn't it? Sometimes you find yourself kind of holding it in your hand, hours at a time. And the display is so beautiful, isn't it? The graphics, unbelievable. And you touch it and things happen. And it's not only this thing itself, but with this little thing, I can go anywhere in the world. And I can stay in touch with people I love constantly because they're over here sending me a picture of what they just did. And I can send them, I like that image, back. So I can be in touch with them all the time, many times a day. And I can have a pretty big reference library of Buddhist texts on my iPhone and iPad. I can read the Shobo Genzo anytime I want, wherever I am. And I can phone anybody anywhere. And when I talk to them, I can even see them. As if this were not enough, I'm always ready to take a photograph of something amazing and interesting with the best camera I ever owned in my life. And while I'm standing there on a trail, having just taken a picture of this wonderful oceanscape, I can then format that picture, push a button, and send it to Laura, who will put it on the Everyday Zen website. And by the time I get back from my hike, it might be there on the website. And I have an amazing calendar that keeps track of everything and sends me notices and warnings should I happen to need something. I can immediately order it and it'll probably be there the next day, even if it comes from China. You can see how much I love my phone and my iPad that I write poems on and that I write Dharma talks on, and I'm reading from my iPad right now. I'm surprised that I don't own a lot of stock in Apple. I don't, but I'm surprised. Why don't I? But this technology is bad for me. It's kind of like life, right? Life is great. Life is marvelous. But it's inherently unhealthy, and it kills you in the end. I often say to people, you know, my advice to you is don't get old. It's a problem. But it happens if you're alive. But here's this most subtle and insidious part of it all. Is the way it shapes your very thinking. And you don't know it. When your mind is conditioned by the news and the feeds and the shopping and the whole illusion of speed and of getting things done efficiently as you want them to be done and conveniently and knowing so much and being able to find out so much so quickly. In other words, when your mind is conditioned by this basic world that we now live in, you are going to think a certain way. No matter what you want to think, you are going to think a certain way, and you will not be able to think another way. Your mind will be incapable of entertaining certain kinds of thoughts. They can't occur to you. And if they did occur to you, you would dismiss them because they would seem irrelevant and preposterous. And this is the scariest part. That we could lose track of essential elements of our being human. That there are some things about being human that would fall away from the register of our thinking and feeling. Because, just like me and my Facebook posts, even if we thought of those things, say love, compassion, the virtue of silence, wonder, or the passion of truth, our context, our medium, would distort these very things. And even though we would call them by the same words and think we were accessing them, we wouldn't be. To me, that's the worst part. That this could be happening to us and we wouldn't even know it. So I always think of the story in the Book of Serenity about Dizhang and Tsueshan. I'm sure many of you know this story. Dizhang asks Tsueshan, "Where do you come from?" And Tsueshan says, "I come from the south." Dizhang says, "How is Buddhism in the south these days?" And Tsueshan said, "There is extensive discussion." Dizhang said, "How can that compare to me here planting the fields and making rice to eat?" And Tsueshan said, "What can you do about the world?" Dizhang said, "What do you call the world?" Good question. What do we call the world? What do we think the world is? Is the world we think we're living in the world that is so compelling and has so much behind it, so much money and institutions and talk and technology? Is this world that we read about and scroll about and discuss with our friends the actual world? Well, maybe yes and no. I think we're pretty good on the yes part, and maybe not so good on the no part. And that's why we're here today, whatever our intentions may have been. We're here to remember that the world we think is the world is not the world. So I'm saying this to remind myself and you that it is really, really essential that we practice. It's really essential that we have a daily practice and a weekly practice and a yearly cycle of practice, and that we do Zazen regularly with commitment, and we sit deeply from time to time, throwing away everything and just plunging into our sitting, because it's really essential for all of us that once in a while we step as firmly as we can outside the spinning context of this world in order to remember that the world is more than we think it is. Not that we can necessarily know the world. Not that we can necessarily ever know ourselves, as our tradition tells us. Not knowing is most intimate. Not knowing brings us closest to the truth. But in the world we live in now, not knowing is terrible. Not knowing is a big failure. Not knowing gets us agitated and nervous. We feel we ought to know. We must know. But in our practice, it's the opposite. Not knowing is best. And we really appreciate not knowing. And we enjoy it. In many ways, knowing is an illusion. Knowing is utterly naive. So as you've been doing today, and as you will do for the rest of the day, just sit and just breathe. Breathe every single breath. And just be with whatever happens in the body and the mind. Don't solve any problems. Don't have any insights. Don't make any lists or resolutions. Don't improve your health or your state of mind. Just sit right in the middle of Buddha's heart. For me, as some of you may know, poetry is another addiction. It's another way that I remember that I don't know. Here's some recent poems. They all have the same title, poem. Here's one. I don't see a problem with setting any of this down on paper if it's true as I think it is when I say it, which is now in the life I seem to be living when I'm saying what it is I have to say, but don't get me or it wrong. I mean, over or underestimate the point I'm trying to make. There must be some specific rules for a living. You can figure it out if you try hard enough to do that and consult some expert, some data, and well, just some simple tried and true human wisdom through the ages, common sense. How complicated, after all, can it be just to get through a life without all that much trouble? Just being decent enough can't really be that hard. They say the purpose of life is to be happy, maybe also to do somebody some good if possible, but this raises several questions. There are questions always because people talk to one another and themselves, which makes almost everything soon unclear, at least if you pay attention. Next, the rules of the game, rules of the road, so to speak, so you can go on without bumping into the next guy, without cracking up and making a mess, something rather than nothing, some idea like that. Swimming is fine in summer, light on earth, filling the sky is great. As are high clouds, trees swaying in wind, crocuses after first snow, and so forth. I like to look down a long, lonely, winding road in dry, rolling country. You know, that lonely feeling of infinity, though why infinity is lonely, I don't know. Do you? Infinity is just an idea, a feeling, a reason for commas. But an ocean is bracing. It is so large, so long, and so deep. Spinoza would have appreciated graveyards in large cities, though he had his doubts about death, while I have mine. Which brings us again to rules and words and meanings and to all the things we are forced to avoid in life in order to get by. Poem. Others are forever with you when they're with you, and you are here where others are others only insofar as others render unto Caesar, etc. Others are tantamount to a cascade of moss-hung elm, a field of daisies or grasses, wildly waving branchlets among people in trees or on roads when they move about themselves. And the others in their way are the ways of others always in the way, insofar as you want to get to where you are in your own way. Others in the way mark the way as the way. If the others were not in the way would be so lonesome you could die without the others, of loneliness and lack of air. For others are the air you breathe, the way you walk, the sea you plunge into. Others are fated to be here in you. You are where they live. Others are you. You must be them. Others are never others. They must be other than themselves, other than the others you take them to be. I'm so grateful to others, to you, to everyone. Maybe that's the closest we will come to knowing what the world is. It's others and our feelings about and the feelings of others. Here's a short piece that I wrote for Lion's Roar, the Buddhist magazine. I'll close with this. It's about emotions. It's about feelings. Life is very emotional. It's a constant flow of feelings. Sometimes overwhelming, sometimes hardly noticeable, but always there. Strong emotions like grief or fury can knock us entirely out of commission. But even barely noticeable emotions have their effects, because even when they seem to pass away, emotions can remain buried somehow within us and can affect our behavior and our general point of view in ways we probably don't understand. Freud and his successors gave us the idea of the unconscious to explain how this happens. And long, long before Freud, the Buddha and his successors created a developed discourse about emotions and how to clarify them so that we could know how to move from disturbing emotions like fear, anger, or anxiety that destabilize and cause suffering to self and others, to beautiful emotions like compassion and love that can shape our conduct and our experience of living in beautiful ways. The Buddha called negative or disturbing emotions kleshas, whose fundamental source was the three poisons of attachment, aversion, and delusion. Coping with and eventually knowing how to transform kleshas is a key, if not the key, Dharma practice. Like everyone else I know, in recent years, my emotions have been aroused not only by things that happen to me personally, but also by my reactions to things that have been happening to my friends, my family, and in the world at large. Just keeping up with friends' illnesses and deaths, not even mentioning the disturbing news I read every day that seems to augur a terrible human future. This is an overwhelming experience. How to cope with this without going numb or crazy with fear, worry, and grief? It really, really helps to have a daily meditation practice that you do whether you feel like it or not. Every day when I sit, usually the first thing in the morning, I open myself to whatever feelings arise in me. I said before, Zazen is space. And in the spaciousness of Zazen, I don't experience these feelings as disturbing as I might otherwise. They can come up in the space. They can go away. If somehow I'm compelled to latch onto them, making them more disturbing, I can see this pretty quickly. And I just keep breathing. I put my attention on my breathing and my belly really strong. And things calm down. And I can bring peace to my disturbances. On many days, it's just peace, a beautiful thing. Zazen is a daily practice of being open to and wise with my own emotions. And if I can do it during Zazen, I can more easily do it during the rest of the day. I can be disturbed without really being disturbed. Because I want to be disturbed. When I read about or see within my circle of friends and family dismaying things, I want to be dismayed. To be cooled out and indifferent to what is going on around me just seems like a bad idea. Probably if I was like that, it would be unhealthy. Probably I would be burying my emotions. And even if I weren't, to be disengaged and happy when others are suffering strikes me as inhumane. I would rather be a human being like other human beings who feel bad when conditions are bad, who cry when there's something to cry about, and whose compassionate emotions spur them to act to make things better. But in order to sustain that kind of being disturbed, I also need to be not disturbed. In other words, I have to be able to live through and with my disturbance without being eaten up by it. In the Buddhist analysis of kleshas, the key element is clinging. That's what makes a klesha, is that it compels you. It contains an element of clinging that compels you to make more of it, produce more of it. And clinging can sometimes appear in the opposite way. It can sometimes appear as aversion, delusion, denial, depression, which has the effect of burying the disturbing feelings. So you go numb rather than freak out. So in other words, my anxiety is not necessarily a klesha if I am not compelled by it, if I can experience it fully and have the capacity to let go of it. And that's the kind of effort I make. And that's how I can practice being disturbed without being disturbed. This practice takes a certain amount of patience and faith. Patience because sometimes you can't do it very well and you have to just bear with it. Keep on going without getting frustrated. And faith, because I have to have faith that the practice will work to keep me safe and sane. Fortunately for me, patience and faith are not innate qualities. They are qualities that develop naturally as you practice. And since my practice is long and has been steady, not because of me, but because other people have kept me on the beam for a long time. I have enough patience and faith to keep me going. I can't be human without being overcome by my humanity. So it may be that the world we live in now, with all of its immense material advantages, unprecedented, right, in the history of the world, is at the same time making it harder for us to be human without being overcome by our humanity. Forcing us to be closed rather than open to ourselves and others, or getting us so agitated and anxious that we can't sit still long enough to see past the view of the moment to a broader and deeper truth. And that's why we sit. It's not just another nice thing that we can do. It's more fundamental than that, and more crucial than that. We sit today. We sit next month. We sit the month after that, and the month after that. We sit Sesshin. We do practice period. It's the backbone, the strength of our lives. So thank all of you for understanding this and being here today, because you know that.